Democratic National Convention in Chicago. This is Democracy Now!, War, Peace, and the Presidency, breaking with convention.
Our nation with this election has a precious, fleeting opportunity to move past the bitterness, cynicism, and divisive battles of the past, a chance to chart a new way forward.
Before a thunderous crowd of 20,000, Vice President Kamala Harris formally accepts the Democratic Party's presidential nomination. If she wins, she becomes the first woman, the first Black woman, the first person of South Asian descent to be elected U.S. president. We'll air part of Harris's speech and get response. Plus, we speak to Democratic Texas Congressmember Greg Kassar about U.S. policy on immigration and Gaza. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency, breaking with convention. I'm Amy Goodman in Chicago. Vice President Kamala Harris formally accepted the Democratic presidential nomination Thursday night in Chicago.
On behalf of everyone whose story could only be written in the greatest nation on earth, I accept your nomination.
During her remarks, Kamala Harris reiterated her support for Israel while also calling for its U.S.-backed war on Gaza to end.
President Biden and I are working to end this war such that Israel is secure, the hostages are released, the suffering in Gaza ends, and the Palestinian people can realize their right to dignity, security,
Protests outside the DNC continued Thursday as thousands marched through the streets of Chicago demanding the Democratic Party urgently shift gears on Gaza and end support for Israel's war. Delegates from the Uncommitted Movement locked arms and walked inside the DNC halls wearing Palestinian keffiyehs. One day after the DNC refused to allow a Palestinian-American speaker to take the main stage. Uncommitted delegates circled the halls of the United Center arm in arm until eventually they were allowed to take their seats on the convention floor in their various delegations. In Gaza, the UN says it'll begin vaccinating children against polio by the end of the month amidst fears of a massive outbreak. This comes as Israeli attacks continue to kill besieged Gazans, with Israeli soldiers pushing into Deir al-Balah in central Gaza and Khan Yunis in the south. Israeli negotiators have returned from more ceasefire talks in Cairo as Israel continues to rebuff Hamas's demand for Israel's complete withdrawal from Gaza. On Thursday, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Linda Thomas-Greenfield told the U.N. Security Council a ceasefire and hostage deal is, quote, now in sight. Riyad Mansour, Palestine's U.N. envoy, also addressed the Security Council Thursday.
Stop the bleeding in Gaza. Impose an immediate ceasefire. Stop the suffering. Protect our children and all our civilians as international law and our collective humanity demand. End this genocide. End it now.
Israel's killed over 40,200 Palestinians in Gaza since October 7th and injured 93,000, though those official tallies are certainly far lower than the true toll. A new report from the Pacific Institute finds a 50% increase over the past year in global water-related violence as a direct result of Israel's attacks on Gaza and the occupied West Bank. Attacks by Israeli settlers and the Israeli military on Palestinian water supplies accounted for a quarter of all water-related conflicts last year. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is warning low-lying Pacific Island nations could be wiped off the map due to the worsening climate catastrophe. Guterres spoke from Samoa, where he met with communities forced to move their homes inland to protect from the threat of rising sea levels and increasingly severe weather events.
Those that lived in these houses had to move their homes further inland because of sea level rise and the multiplication of storms. Sea level rise is accelerating. It's not the double of what it was in the 90s. If we are not able to stop what is happening with climate change, this problem that we see in Samoa will not stay in Samoa. It will be happening more and more everywhere, in all coastal areas, from New York to Shanghai, from Lagos to Bangkok.
Guterres' visit comes ahead of the 53rd Pacific Islands Forum Leaders Meeting, which he will attend in Tonga next week. Guterres called on weather nations to uphold their financing commitments ahead of November's UN Climate Summit, COP29, in Baku, Azerbaijan. Democracy Now! Will be there broadcasting from the summit. In Bangladesh, massive flooding has killed at least 13 people and displaced or otherwise affected 4.5 million others as rescuers rush to evacuate flooded communities to safety. Bangladesh is one of the countries most vulnerable to disasters and climate change, according to the Global Climate Risk Index. In Brazil, firefighters are working to combat blazes in the Amazon as an intense drought has turned the once humid environment into kindling. Over 500,000 residents of the city of Porto Velho in northern Brazil have been breathing in heavy smoke-filled air. In more climate change news, a new study points to global heating as the cause of death for billions of crabs that died in the Bering Sea near Alaska in 2022. The findings track with other scientific evidence. The Arctic is warming up at a much higher rate than other regions, wreaking havoc for local ecosystems and livelihoods. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is in Ukraine for talks with President Volodymyr Zelensky just weeks after Modi met with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow. Modi's called on both parties to return to peace as he attempts to push a diplomatic resolution to Russia's invasion. This comes amidst reports of intense fighting in eastern Ukraine. Putin's accused Ukraine of trying to attack a nuclear plant in Kursk, where Ukrainian forces have been making major advances following its surprise incursion earlier this month.
The enemy tried to strike at the Kursk nuclear power station last night. The International Atomic Energy Agency has been informed. They promised to come themselves to send specialists to assess the situation. I hope that in the end, this will be done on their part.
UN nuclear agents will visit Russia's Kursk plant next week. In Burma, thousands more Rohingya Muslims are being forced to flee as armed groups continue to target communities after seizing control of Burma's Rakhine State, shelling villages and rounding up men. Many refugees have been forced to escape on boats to seek safety elsewhere. On Sunday, the Rohingya community will mark the 7th anniversary of the Burmese assault that drove hundreds of thousands of Rohingya from their homes. In education news, the incoming freshman class at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, has a significantly smaller share of black students following last year's Supreme Court decision striking down affirmative action in college admissions. The class of 2028 is just 5% black versus 13% in prior years. The percentage of Latinx students fell from 15 to 11%. MIT President Sally Kornbluth said, quote, "We expected the ruling to pose a serious challenge to sustaining the diverse mix of students who make MIT the place it is today. Now that the class of 2028 has enrolled, the impact is clear and it's concerning," she said. In other education news, the President of the University of California has ordered all 10 UC campuses to ban protest encampments, as well as wearing face masks on campus as the new school year kicks off. The order comes months after students at U.S. college campuses set off a nationwide uprising in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza. Many schools cracked down on the peaceful protests, violently clearing encampments and suspending students who took part in them. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration's approved updated COVID shots for people 12 and older. The FDA accelerated its approval of the mRNA vaccines produced by Pfizer and Moderna as U.S. cases this summer soar to the highest level in at least 2 years. COVID-19 continues to claim hundreds of lives across the U.S. each week. And in more public health news, Thai officials say they've confirmed the presence of the new deadlier strain of Mpox in a European patient who recently traveled to Thailand. Thai authorities are now requiring travelers from 42 different countries to undergo testing on arrival. Meanwhile, Congolese authorities recently reported over 1,000 new Mpox cases in a week as they appealed to the international community for the urgent delivery of vaccines. The World Health Organization earlier this month declared Mpox a global public health emergency. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. War, peace, and the presidency. We're breaking with convention. When we come back, we'll air part of Kamala Harris's address to the Democratic National Convention and get response. Towards Truth by Sunny Singh. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. War, peace, and the presidency. We're breaking with convention. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez here in Chicago.
Well, Vice President Kamala Harris formally accepted the Democratic presidential nomination Thursday night here in Chicago. This comes just over a month after President Biden dropped his reelection bid, upending the 2024 race. This is part of what he said.
On behalf of everyone whose story could only be written in the greatest nation on earth,
she too.
And with this election, our nation with this election has a precious, fleeting opportunity to move past the bitterness, cynicism, and divisive battles of the past, a chance to chart a new way forward. Not as members of any one party or faction, but as Americans. And let me say, I know there are people of various political views watching tonight. You to know, I promise to be a president for all Americans. You can always trust me to put country above party and self, to hold sacred America's fundamental principles, from the rule of law to free and fair elections to the peaceful transfer of power.
Kamala Harris giving her acceptance speech here in Chicago at the Democratic National Convention. We're joined by three guests. Barbara Ransby is a historian, author, and activist, professor of Black Studies, Gender, and Women's Studies and History at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Her latest book, Making All Black Lives Matter, Reimagining Freedom in the 21st Century. We're also joined by Mohammed Kader, manager of policy and advocacy campaigns at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. He previously served as a staffer in the U.S. Senate. He's also a Black Mississippian and a Palestinian. And we're joined by Maurice, well, Mo Mitchell, National Director for the Working Families Party. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Mo Mitchell, your party, the Working Families Party, has endorsed Kamala Harris. Can you talk about the significance of last night and why their party has decided to endorse her?
Absolutely. And it's great to be here. So the Working Families Party rendered an endorsement for Vice President Harris and now Vice President Harris and Tim Walz. And we did it because we understand the stakes, the global stakes, the fact that there's authoritarians from Israel and Palestine and Hungary and France and the United States attempting to not just move our country, but our world towards authoritarianism, towards nationalism. And it's up to us, again, not any politician, but the millions of people that I talked to in North Philadelphia, here in Chicago, who are trying to figure out how to make ends meet. It's up to us to build a mass movement in order to defeat them. And electorally, the way that we do it is by uniting with the Democrats in this election to defeat MAGA. What I heard is a presidential candidate call for Palestinian rights and Palestinian self-determination. We need to ensure that that rhetoric turns into a ceasefire and an arms embargo. What I heard from Tim Walz was calling for housing as a human right, and also for, I think, housing as a human right and other fundamental human rights. We need to translate that into fundamental policy. That's on us. I mean, last time we endorsed Joe Biden, he wasn't our first, second, or third pick. And under Biden, a candidate that is no progressive, we were able to, our grassroots movements were able to secure transformative investments in people, in climate, Justice 40 provisions, which came from the grassroots. Those are our victories. So again, our strategy is a block and build strategy. We need to block the authoritarians, and then we need to build movements outside of the Democratic Party in order to demand that these pieces of rhetoric turn into concrete action. And that's not just one election. That's going to happen over, again, decades. We must defeat Trump, but Trumpism, the defeat of Trumpism and the far right is a movement prerogative that will take, I think, the next decade or more. This is a generational fight, and I believe that job number one is to ensure that MAGA and Trump is defeated. Job number two is, once we do a victory lap against MAGA, that we do the organizing in order to make sure that our movements' demands become the agenda of the Walz and the Harris administration.
But I wanted to ask you, inevitably, once the Democratic presidential candidate is established, there are those sectors of society, the private equity folks, the wealthiest of Americans, who then try to really grab control and influence over the candidate. How are you going to be able to counter that?
This is why we build the Working Families Party. Because we believe that fundamentally the forces, the two-party system, the forces of capital, are very powerful. They organize. They understand the stakes, which is why that they make endorsements, which is why that they lobby. And we believe that a organized grassroots movement can defeat capital. We've seen it happen. I was with Sean Fain the other day. I was with some of our leaders, independent leaders like Ilhan Omar, who were protesting and standing up against the fact that there were no Palestinians platformed, which I thought was a missed opportunity for the Democratic Party. Again, it's our job. I want to center our people. Our democracy is our people. We can't be spectators. We can't be pundits and simply hope may be that we get people elected and then they translate that into victories for us. We need to get the people that we think that we could organize the best elected and then push and organize them. We've actually seen that work. And again, corporate America, they're thinking the same thing. And so it's important for us to build independent political projects. It's important for us to work with grassroots organizations, labor organizations, and movement organizations like Uncommitted in order to demand the freedom that we deserve. Electoral politics is just one piece of the fight. That allows us to reset the balance of power and decide who we're going to be organizing with and also organizing against in order to demonstrate over 4 years what we could win. And then we do it all over again. Elections aren't the prize. Governing is the prize, and governing happens every single day.
And just one thing to clarify for people who aren't aware, Mo Mitchell, of the Working Families Party, because not all over the country, but in New York, for example, you have a line in the ballot. I mean, you can vote, for example, we'll be able to vote for Kamala Harris either in the Working Families line or the Democratic Party line.
Yes, and if I could add, the Working Families Party is a 25-year-old independent third-party project. We're building a third party from the ground up, not from the top down. Some people build third parties from the top down. Every 4 years, there'll be a charismatic person who runs at the top of the ticket. We have a ballot line in New York. We have a ballot line in Connecticut. And we're building state by state by state over the next decade in order to create the grassroots infrastructure county by county, in order for this project, unions, grassroots movements, independence, in order to surface from the ground up. Kendra Brooks and Nicholas O'Rourke in Philadelphia is a perfect example of independent Working Families Party candidates who are delivering for people in concrete ways. We believe that that formula over time can be able to unlock this expression that's being tied up with organized capital in the two-party system in a real way to be able to get those concessions for people. And then, yes, there are voters in New York who could vote proudly on the Working Families Party line to say that, yes, we recognize the binary fight between MAGA and the Democrats, and we're clear about that. But also, we have our own interests, labor and community interests, that we want expressed here on the ballot.
I'd like to bring in Mohammed Kader to the conversation. You're an African-American from Mississippi and also Palestinian. Your response to how the Democratic Party handled the issue of the genocide in Palestine, and if you could talk to us a little bit about your background.
Thank you. The Democratic Party and official or party members have really failed to meet the moment. You know, right now we're seeing a genocide unlike any other in the 21st century. Mass atrocities and war crimes that are happening right now with U.S. weapons, with paid by U.S. taxpayer dollars. We know that a majority of the Democratic Party base actually supports what we're calling for, an arms embargo and a permanent ceasefire. Right now, obviously throughout the week, party officials really dropped the ball. We expected a Palestinian to address the floor. Nearly every mention of Gaza, as you saw from Kamala Harris to Keith Ellison to others on the floor, whenever that was mentioned, the party, the members were ecstatic, and it was just a missed opportunity. And you know, for me, I saw clear examples and clear connections to the 1964 DNC, where Black Mississippians like my family and others who were organizing throughout the decade, you know, were sidelined, but also missed opportunity there too.
So your father is from Nablus in the occupied West Bank. Your mom from Macomb, Mississippi. Yes. Your great uncle worked with Bob Moses, the great civil rights activist, yes, in Mississippi. Talk more about how you put these issues together, and also your response to Kamala Harris.
Yes, you know, I come from a very, historic family. My grandfather's brother and his siblings were sharecroppers, born as sharecroppers as children. They saw the murders of Emmett Till. They saw the murders of Chaney Schwerner and the civil rights workers who came down from the North to help Mississippians register to vote and during Freedom Summer. And in 1961, actually, my grandfather's brother, with the help of Bob Moses, registered to vote along with eight other Black Mississippians. Mm. The next year, Bob Moses invited Fannie Lou Hamer to a conference in Nashville, Tennessee. From there, she became a community organizer, and what we saw in 1964 was the direct result of people that Bob Moses brought in from around the state. People like my grandfather's brother, people like Fannie, people like others as well. And for me, you know, Kamala Harris is a very important person right now. She said that we'll chart a new path. Well, it's difficult to chart a new path when you're not turning the page on antiquated foreign policy, continuing to double down on sending bombs and weapons to kill Palestinians in Gaza, not turning the page, is not charting a new path. And frankly, if Kamala Harris wants to meet the moment, she must include a new foreign policy that centers Palestinians and not centers weapons and war overseas in Palestine and Israel.
And Barbara Ramsey, I'm wondering, as you hear Maurice Mitchell, Mohammed Kader talk, your reaction to the continued activism of young Americans seeking a new path for American diplomacy and actions around the world.
Yeah. Well, you know, I hear the historian in me is very interested in this story about Mississippi, and the activist in me, you know, talks to Mo Mitchell all the time when I want to get insights about electoral politics. You know, I think the thing that Mo Mitchell said that's very important is, one, the importance of defeating fascism at the polls, right? And that's important not only because there are an array of issues that there's a great divergence between the Democrats and Republicans on, but also in order to have the oxygen in order to continue the protests in solidarity with Palestine. If we have an authoritarian regime in power, we're going to have very much difficulty doing that. And the young people who've been so heroic on college campuses around the country with encampments and so forth, young people also like Mo, who I met at a political conference not long ago, you know, would meet with, I'm afraid, military and live ammunition as opposed to rubber bullets. The liberal leaders of academia certainly have shamed themselves in the way that they've treated these protests, and I'm, you know, just can't say enough critical about that. But I can't imagine worse scenarios, and I think we have to keep that in mind. The other thing that Mo Mitchell said is talking about the Working Families Party. For me, because of the real difficulty supporting what the Democrats are doing in Gaza, you know, supporting them while we watch what they're doing in Gaza, which is nothing less than a genocide, suggests to me the need to break out of the two-party system and to have real choices where an Ilhan Omar, a Summer Lee, a Rashida Tlaib would feel politically much more at home than they do in the Democratic Party. And the other thing I just think is, you know, it is a sobering moment, and I cannot be, you know, enthusiastically supportive of anybody on the ballot. Nobody represents my values. And so in some ways it's voting and organizing, which I think is also the Working Families Party's position. We need a movement, and that is really what's going to advance the, you know, issues that we, all of us around this table, believe in so deeply, much more than who we pick at the head of the, you know, at the head of a party ticket.
Mohammed Kader, what happened to you when you went when you visited family in near Nablus in 2022?
Yes, you know, I, like any other person who visits from the United States, endured the same experience that I think everybody knows. You land in Tel Aviv at the airport and you're either interrogated, detained, or you have no problem. For me, I was interrogated. And for me, that moment when I was on the ground, it was no different between what my family endured under Jim Crow here in the United States. Clear as day apartheid. Apartheid walls, different set of laws, different set of standards that people are allowed to go through, Palestinian-only buses that you're allowed to take. For me, the lack of water, lack of clean water, was very clear. Mississippi right now actually has the same issue, no clean water in the state capital, Jackson, Mississippi. For me, seeing my family there under those conditions was very clear, the conditions that my grandparents endured in Mississippi in the early 20th century.
Can I just add something to Mo's comment? I went on a feminist of color delegation in 2011 to Palestine, and there was someone who had grown up on an Indian reservation in the United States and someone who had grown up in the Jim Crow South, and they talked about how similar the experiences were, how much when seeing the way that the IDF were treating Palestinians in the streets and the extreme segregation, the apartheid there. And third person grew up in South Africa. So we had this representation of the global nature of settler colonialism and various forms of apartheid.
I wanted to ask Maurice Mitchell, a lot of focus has been on Election Day, but I'm even more concerned about the day after Election Day. And I think, ironically, it was Bill Clinton who actually raised the question in his presentation, not to take anything for granted, because the Trump and his people have made it clear that they're not going to accept a result where he is not the winner. And I'm wondering what your party is doing to prepare for the battles that will come from a sector of American society that, unfortunately, Trump's supporters are well-armed and they're zealots in terms of their beliefs. How you're looking at the day after Election Day?
Absolutely. We don't want to be flat-footed. And I want to go back to two elections, so 2016 and 2008, two very different elections. But I think there's lessons for both of them about what happens after Election Day. So let's talk about 2016. We understand that whatever the outcome, that this movement, this MAGA movement, is anti-democratic and authoritarian, and they will not accept defeat, right? Which means that we have a lot of work to do in order to make sure that this really big pro-democracy coalition stays united and stays vigilant and does the work that we did actually in 2020 in order to ensure that there's a transfer of power. It wasn't a nonviolent transfer of power, but there was a transfer of power. That's going to require everybody to stay in the fight. When Trump and MAGA inevitably attempt to question the legitimacy of the election, to continue to engage in advocacy, continue to have these conversations publicly, because there's a long sort of contested election period between whenever Election Day is and inauguration, where the Trump movement will be animated. Again, but 2008 is also another moment, because that was the Obama hope and change moment. And there's lessons there. It was a historic election, and people were super excited about somebody that actually came from grassroots organizing, the first black president, right? We have another first. That mass movement got demobilized. Again, we need mass movements independent of the two parties that are mobilized, that are ready the day after Election Day, calling for our agenda to be realized. We're organizing for a trifecta. We want the presidency. We want to flip the House so that MAGA no longer controls the House. We want the Democrats to retain the Senate so that we could pass a bold working families agenda day one. That's not going to happen if the forces that are currently engaged and feeling the momentum are demobilized or feel like it was simply their job to get a candidate elected. We have to stay engaged.
Well, I want to thank all of you for being with us. We are going to move into a very interesting segment right now. I want to thank Mo Mitchell, who is the National Director for the Working Families Party here in Chicago for the Democratic National Convention, Barbara Ransby, historian, author, and activist, professor of Black Studies, Gender and Women's Studies, and History at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Her latest book, Making All Black Lives Matter, Reimagining Freedom in the 21st Century, and Muhammad Kader, manager of policy and advocacy campaigns at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, previously served as a staffer in the Senate. He is a Black Mississippian and a Palestinian.
We're broadcasting from Chicago, which is home to the highest concentration of Palestinian Americans in the United States. In the suburbs of the city, residents of the Bridgeview, known as Little Palestine, have been hard hit by Israel's war on Gaza, which has killed over 40,200 Palestinians, including thousands of children, since October, though the true toll is likely much higher.
Democracy Now!'s Maria Teresena and Hanna Elias visited Little Palestine this week to get a tour of the neighborhood.
So right now we're driving into like the southwest suburbs of Chicago. So this consists of like Bridgeview, Little Palestine, it's called Little Palestine. And just like the other southwest suburbs that are surrounding it, there's a huge Arab populations there, huge Muslim populations. I think this community really like started being established in the late 80s, 90s. And there's a huge diasporic people here of Palestinians. And we've been so ingrained in the community here. A lot of people here are directly affected by what's happening in Gaza. and what's happening in Palestine in regards to the occupation and in regards to state violence from the U.S. There was a lot of FBI surveillance in the late 90s and especially after 9/11 on community leaders here and on the mosques here in the community. That actually traumatized a lot of families in the neighborhoods. And after October 7th, definitely we've seen hate crimes and we've seen a lot of violence. But I think our numbers are so strong and we're so powerful, and the fact that we are so big and so present in this city is just a huge like testament to our like power, our cause, and how strong we are as Palestinians, and also just as just a community that's very like unified here in Chicago.
Which business are we standing in front of?
Right now we're in front of Al Basha Suites. They are Palestinian owned.
Hello, how are you?
My name is Razan, and I'm the cashier and manager at Al Basha Suites. Here we have donations for Gaza. Anyone who wants to donate to Gaza can take a free suite, then donate. And then the donation goes to a company that sends the money to Gaza. We try to help in whatever way we can, in a simple way. We will try what we can, and these stickers too. The payment goes to Gaza.
So we're in Little Palestine. Where are you taking us right now?
So right now we're going to one of the biggest coffee houses here in the neighborhood, in the area. It's Palestinian owned. They opened up a few months ago, but they've actually been really, really successful.
My name is Wasif Ibrahim. You know, it's a place for people in the community to come together. We basically started on this project after October 7th.
Why is it so important to support a Palestinian-owned business during a time where pro-Palestinian voices, Palestinian rights voices have faced so much backlash?
So when all this happened, we kind of seen where these corporations took their stance, and we believed that we needed alternatives where we could support ourselves. Not only in the sense that from a business perspective, but also being there for each other, for one another at such a crucial time. Being in Little Palestine, you know, we need that support system to support one another, because you see our politics and our government doesn't really do a good job of supporting us. So we have to be there for one another.
Where is your family from, and how many generations does it go back?
I'm first generation, so my family is from Burka, Annapolis. So my parents' generation were born in Kuwait, and then for me and my siblings, we were all born here in Chicago.
Yeah. Originally, Little Palestine was on the south side of Chicago in the inner city, and they actually used to call it Al-Mukhayyam, which means refugee camp. And so many Palestinians started to come here after the 67 war. Some were displaced in 48, and then they got displaced again in 67, very similar to my family's experience. You've been a community organizer for at least 15 years. Could you talk about what inspired you to get involved?
The issues that been having the Palestinian community has been having has been over 76 years. You know, I actually come from an activist family. When my grandfather came to this country, he wanted a community center, and he actually was one of the founders of the first ever Arab American community center. So I kind of have it in my family. And so, you know, I would also say Obama's failed promises motivated me to go into community organizing.
How does the rhetoric coming out of the Biden administration in regards to its support of Israel, in regards to Gaza, also the way that Biden officials have described pro-Palestinian protests, a lot of them led by students on college campuses, as anti-Semitic, another demonizing language, how has this rhetoric translated into violent attacks and targeting of Palestinian community members, including here in Illinois, outside of Chicago?
After October 7th, he enacted
anti-Arab racism and Islamophobia. It manifested. People took him seriously. Like you just pointed out, Wadia Al-Fayyum, a six-year-old boy whose landlord knew him, went to his apartment and stabbed him 28 times because he thought this kid was going to grow up to be a terrorist. We have the three students in Vermont who were shot for wearing their kufiyas. And Biden gave his sympathies, but it's empty. It's really, really empty. How can you give your sympathies when you're the one who started the fire of this racist rhetoric?
My name is Deanna Othman. I'm from Little Palestine in Oakland in Bridgeview, Illinois. I am a teacher at a local Islamic school, and I'm also a board member of American Muslims for Palestine, Chicago. Many of our students were heavily impacted by October 7th and onward. Many of them regularly visit the West Bank, so they're familiar with the ravages of the occupation. They've seen armed soldiers as they've crossed checkpoints with their families. They've had family members killed. We have students who are from Gaza who have had family missing, family killed. Some of them have lived there in the past, so they've had friends killed, people they've gone to school with. Myself, my husband's family is in Gaza, and I visited there last summer in June and July of 2023. So with my own children, it's been difficult sort of processing it with them because their immediate, like their grandmother is there, their uncle, their aunt, their cousins, and people that they, some of them, they just met for the first time last summer, and now they're worried about losing them. And many of the places where they made memories that summer, lifelong memories, no longer exist anymore. So it's been tough, especially with the younger children, because they can't quite grasp why this would happen, why any government would allow this to happen. And it's difficult to explain why our government, the place that we live, is funding this genocide. So, you know, we've had to process this in many different ways as a community, whether it's through counseling with students in our schools, whether it's through more educational outreach in the greater community, or even just, you know, psychological trauma processing for people who have, you know, experienced major loss.
Some of the voices from Little Palestine. Afterwards, many of them boarded a bus to take part in a march on the Democratic National Convention. Again, Chicago has the largest proportion, the largest concentration of Palestinian Americans in the United States. When we come back, we'll talk about Kamala Harris, immigration, and Gaza with Texas Congressmember Greg Kostar. Stay with us.
I speak for a man who gave for this land, took a bullet in the back for his pain, spilled his blood in the dirt and the dust, and he's come back to say, what he has seen is hard to believe, and it does no good to just pray. All he asked of us to stand and we must in this war today. With his mind he sinned.
No More by Eddie Vedder. The song was featured on the soundtrack for Body of War, a documentary that tells the story of Thomas Young, an Iraq War veteran paralyzed from a bullet to the spine. It was co-directed by the pioneering TV host Phil Donahue, who tackled major social and political issues. Thomas Young became a major anti-war activist. Phil Donahue died this past weekend at the age of 88. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency, Breaking with Convention. I'm Amy Goodman here in Chicago with Juan Gonzalez as we wrap up our 5 days in the Windy City.
In her speech formally accepting the Democratic presidential nomination on Thursday night, Vice President Kamala Harris spoke about a number of topics, including immigration, which is shaping up to be one of the biggest issues of the 2024 race.
And let me be clear. After decades in law enforcement, I know the importance of safety and security, especially at our border. Last year, Joe and I brought together Democrats and conservative Republicans to write the strongest border bill in decades. The Border Patrol endorsed it. But Donald Trump believes a border deal would hurt his campaign. So he ordered his allies in Congress to kill the deal. Well, I refuse to play politics with our security. Bipartisan border security bill that he killed, and I will sign it into law. I know we can live up to our proud heritage as a nation of immigrants and reform our broken immigration system. We can create an earned pathway to citizenship and secure our border.
Kamala Harris addressing the Democratic National Convention last night here in Chicago. Hours before she spoke, Donald Trump traveled to the border in Arizona, where he promised to, quote, seal the border if elected. At his convention in Milwaukee just a month ago, scores of delegates would continually hold up signs that said, mass deportation now. For more, we're joined by Democratic Congressmember Greg Kassar of Texas. He's the whip of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, a labor organizer, the son of Mexican immigrants. He was the youngest member of the Austin City Council before he became a congressmember. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. If you can talk about Kamala Harris's plans for immigration, what you understand they are from her speech last night, and the overall Biden-Harris policy on the border.
I think that the Democratic National Convention showed, especially hearing the vice president's speech, some proof of progress on many issues, and then a real pathway where we have to push. Proof of progress in that on economics and domestic policy. We're seeing labor union leaders speak up. We're hearing her talk about cracking down on corporate landlords and big corporations that are price gouging everyday people. Stuff that you used to just hear Senator Sanders say are now mainstream in the party. That's proof of progress. But on issues like immigration and foreign policy, we have to push. Because her laying out that quote-unquote bipartisan border bill, to me, shows something that we have to be worried about. Because she said that she's committed to a pathway for citizenship for everyday people. And I would support a bill that actually had that in it. But unfortunately, this current bill does not have something in it for everyday immigrant families that have been here 10, 20, 30 years. And so we're ready to compromise and push forward on something that can help people who are here. But unfortunately, our politics have been pushed so far to the right on immigration by Donald Trump that we have to fight back against Trump and try to realign our politics on immigration back to where they were just a few years ago so that we can actually send a bill to a President Harris's desk that actually meets what it is that she's laid out in her speech, which includes both security, but actually also taking care of the immigrant community and providing immigrants' rights.
And Greg, I mentioned in a segment earlier that it seems to me the Democratic Party, as you say, in shifting to the right on immigration, has is really adopting a policy of a kinder, gentler form of mass deportation and militarization. You were recently traveled to South America, because I think what most Americans don't realize that the reductions in border crossings are largely a result of the U.S. pressuring Mexico and now Panama to basically shut down the transit routes of migrants coming up through Central America. Wondering your experience there and the sources of this continued flow of migrants.
Well, you know, the mainstream media focuses on immigration as if it's just a border issue. But immigration doesn't start at the border. It starts in people's home countries, economies that have been destabilized, democracies that have been destabilized. And so we've founded now in the Congress the Global Migration Caucus, where we're going to start talking about those issues that people don't want to talk about in Washington, D.C., how the United States' own policies contribute to mass displacement of people out of places like South America. And if we actually help people stay in their home countries, not force people out, then actually that'd be a humane and thoughtful way of reducing mass migration.
And your sense of there's been a lot of emphasis, again, in the media on the fact that many immigrants, even African-Americans and Latinos, are shifting more and more into the MAGA camp. What your sense of that, how accurate that is?
The overwhelming majority of the Latino community, African-American community, continue to vote for the Democratic Party. But we are losing some number of those voters, especially working class voters outside of our big cities, who want to see us actually deliver on the day-to-day economics. They're working their tails off, and they want to see a party that actually delivers for them. And if we don't want them to be vulnerable to Trumpism or to a strongman, then we need to actually show that we can deliver the goods. And that's what I've been most excited about at this Democratic National Convention, is I think so many parts of the corporate parts of the Democratic Party are starting to lose. I mean, you didn't see very much representation from them. You heard a much more clear message saying, we're going to speak to those working class voters, say, we're going to raise your wages. We're going to take on the people that have been raising your rents and raising prices at the grocery store. And I think that's how we bring those voters back into the fold.
Congressmember Kassar, I want to dig more deeply into this so-called bipartisan bill that was really majorly crafted by the Republicans. So rightly, Kamala Harris and others say, here the Republicans crafted it, and Donald Trump urged them then to go against their own bill. But she said, we're going to pass this. For people who haven't been following it more closely, the immigration bill, explain what you think the problems are with it. And are you concerned that if there is a, if Kamala Harris does become president, they're just going to push forward on passing that bill, implementing that bill?
Yeah, let me get into the weeds a little bit here for your viewers and listeners, because I know they care deeply about this, and we're going to be talking a lot about it. The way this bill was crafted, it was not a comprehensive immigration reform bill. It was a bill about Ukraine. And you might say, Greg, what does this have to do with Ukraine? Well, traditionally, the way that it has worked is that Republicans have demanded some amount of anti-immigrant measures in exchange for Democrats saying, let's finally win some immigrant rights. And that's the only way we've ever seen that we could maybe win immigrants in this country some of their rights back. But in this case, what ended up happening was Republicans held money hostage on the Ukraine front. So Democrats in the Senate, who were honest and transparent, said, we're negotiating for Ukraine money, and we're going to give away immigrant rights in exchange. Now, so this bill, now no, the Ukraine money has been passed. So now all that's left is the Republican parts of the bill. And so I think that if we actually want to bring a bill to the floor, we should actually negotiate for something for immigrants' rights. We should negotiate the Democratic portion of the bill, because all that's really left in the bill is the Republican portion. That's where I see some chance of hope, is I think Vice President Harris says, I will sign something into law that provides security and immigrants' rights. And I'm ready to and willing to fight to make sure that immigrants' rights are actually in the bill, because the current version just has the Republican stuff in it.
Now, you're a congressman from Texas. Your governor has been much in the news on these issues of immigration in the last couple of years. Your sense of what is going on in Texas, especially given the huge portion of the Texas population that is of Latin American origin?
There are immigrants throughout Texas. And there's also people of Latin American origin where the border crossed them. Mm-hmm. We understand that immigration is a core part of how Texas works. What people have been concerned about is seeing disorder, seeing all these images at the border, and people want there to be orderly and safe and legal pathways to migration. But where Governor Abbott and Donald Trump's allies have been doing their work, has been trying to make the system as disorderly as possible to their benefit. And that's where I think the vice president was spot on in her speech. She's been pointing out that the arsonists in the situation, the right wing, are also trying to point the finger at any firefighters, anybody trying to fix the system. They try to blame us for the disorder that they themselves have caused. And so immigration ultimately benefits us economically, culturally, in basically every way possible. We just have to figure out a better way to actually create legal pathways, get through this right-wing rhetoric. And if we can create legal pathways for migration, I think so many of these Abbott stunts just won't stick.
And you also have an important Senate race in Texas. Could you talk about
and
the prospects of what whether Ted Cruz will prevail?
We've got a chance to send Ted Cruz packing. Abandoned us everyday Texans during things like our winter storm, where he went to vacation on the beach while Texans were freezing and dying in their homes. Colin Allred gave a good speech last night and continues to present an alternative to probably one of the most unlikable people in politics in Ted Cruz. I think something for folks to remember is my city, the city of Austin, voted for George W. Bush not that long ago for president. Barack Obama lost to Mitt Romney by about 17 points. Joe Biden only lost Texas by 5 points. Ted Cruz didn't get 51% of the vote in his last election. So Texas truly is the largest battleground state in this country. And the arc of history is long, but we're getting over the hill. And we are closing in on becoming a truly purple state. But it's going to take voter registration and inspiring voters. And I think what we learned from this swap at the top of the ticket is if we actually listen to our voters and give them something to hope for, they'll respond.
President Biden charged his vice president, Kamala Harris, with looking at the roots of why people come to the United States. She famously went to Guatemala in 2021, and she said, "Do not come here. Do not come here," referring to the United States. If you can comment on what she had to say and what you feel needs to be the message, and also talk about your recent trip to Colombia.
I recently was in Colombia for the first ever Pan-American Congress. We had legislators from about a dozen different countries come together and talk about this question of the root causes of migration. And so instead of just talking about it, I think people in places like Texas want to see the Democratic Party take steps that are effective. And some of these can be no-cost steps. The United States own sanctions and blockades on everyday working people in Cuba. The way that our sanctions have not actually changed the behavior of people like Maduro, but instead have contributed to the starvation and desperation of people in Venezuela, everyday people there, is part of what is driving people to migrate. And that's the conversation that, I mean, everybody that was at that from a dozen different countries have said, you don't even have to spend money on this. Just stop punishing working people and poor people in Latin America, and that could make a huge difference. And so I'm hopeful that we have now a presidential candidate that has had to work on these issues. And I think while investing in Latin America is important, I think we could also just take our foot off the gas off of punishing working people in those countries.
And you are one of the youngest a member of the Austin City Council, then a young congressman. Your sense of the role of young people today in terms of changing politics in this country?
And we just have 20 seconds.
Well, young people were the heart of the civil rights movement and the heart of the anti-war movement, and I think they're the heart of what's transforming the Democratic Party right now into something we can truly be proud of.
And 10 seconds, you went out to the Uncommitted News Conference to show your support for those delegates who were there to say, calling for a U.S. arms embargo against Israel.
There is really no reason for us to not use our full leverage to achieve that vision of ending bombing in Gaza, and we've got to keep fighting to protect those everyday lives.
Greg Cassar, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Congressman, Democrat from Texas, whip of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, labor organizer, son of Mexican immigrants. And that does it for our week of production here in Chicago during the Democratic National Convention. We've been hosted here at CAN TV, Chicago's public access television. A very special thanks to the CAN TV crew, Darius Hillman, David Tainer, Jason Bryant, Jeremy Fry, Jim Knightwright, Rocio Santos, Imani Payne, Kenny Nelson, Alan Voss, David Greenleaf, Lynette Rodriguez, Keith McDonald, Anita Targus, Marissa Moffitt, and our amazing crew here, Mike Burke, Renee Felt, Sharifa Dvokadus, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Sam Alkoff, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.